Hi everyone, this is Ed. Coyle and I recorded this following episode on Western civilization some time ago, well before Iowa Congressman Steve King made his recent comments to the New York Times saying, "White nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive?" That quote was met with striking rebukes from leaders within his own party, and House leadership decided to remove him from his committee seats. But it obviously wasn't the first time that Representative King has made similar kinds of comments about Western civilization, and appeals to the preservation of Western civilization are often made by evangelicals when expressing worry about contemporary social life. So now seems like a good time to drop this episode. We hope you enjoy it.
You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the City of Man podcast. This is Ed Saul, an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara. And with me, as always, is Coyle Neal, assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. You know, it's funny. Are you a fan of the Beatles at all?
I mean, they have five or six songs that I like, but I wouldn't say I'm a Beatles fanatic. I like, what is it, the White Album? And I don't know that I could name any other music they've made.
Well, that can't be true. I mean, come on. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, Let It Be, Hey Jude.
Yeah, they're fine.
Hard Day's Night, Drive My Car. Anyways, why am I talking about this?
I don't know.
Well, with the Beatles, there are like Paul songs, right? And there are John songs, like they're performing as a band, but there are certain songs and it's really clear that they've been written by one of them or the other. Today's episode is a kind of an Ed. It's an Ed episode. Some episodes are a little bit, I mean, I don't know. Usually we kind of settle on topics jointly, but today is an Ed episode insofar as our topic today is Western civilization in decline. Is something that I've been thinking about, and I was excited to do a episode on it, if only to give me the opportunity to sort of clarify what I think about the topic. And interestingly, sometimes we have topics that Coyle and I haven't talked about, and I never know what he's going to say or how the conversation is going to go. I mean, sometimes I do know what he's going to say and how the conversation is going to go, but this is one of those days when I have no idea what you're going to say and how the conversation is going to go. But again, the idea for the topic arose for me out of those articles that one will periodically see about the decline of Western civilization. It seems like just about every major conservative commentator, whether it's Ross Douthat or David Brooks or Rod Dreher or David French, they have a column, it seems like every couple of months, lamenting or warning about the decline of Western civilization. Progressive commentators, for what it's worth, will also often have articles about decline as well. But it's pretty rare, I think, that Western civilization is taken to be what's at stake in a lot of those articles. And I have to say, for my part, like, these pronouncements of doom have always left me a little suspicious, especially actually when they're uttered by Christians. That gets me particularly nervous. Or when the decline is presented as something in which Christians have a big, important stake, like our calling as Christians is to defend and protect something called Western civilization. So I have a kind of a suspicion about these, but though it's a suspicion that I've always sort of wanted to work out and get a better grip on what exactly is motivating both those worries about Western civilization, the bits that that I agree with in those worries, and then also the bits that that I find problematic. And I should say, at least for my part, like, I'm deeply committed to like many of these Western values and ideas. I'm a philosopher. I, you know, sometimes when I'm on an airplane or something like that, And somebody will ask me what I do, and I'm like, oh, I'm a professor of philosophy. And I always wonder what goes through their head. But philosophy, academic philosophy in the United States is a very conservative discipline in some ways. I mean, I'm sure the vast majority of philosophers in the United States are politically progressive, but the discipline itself is pretty conservative insofar as it revolves around the writings, the problems, the frameworks that have been set up in the philosophical canon arising from Socrates, running through European thinkers through the Middle Age and the modern period up until today. It's all dead or almost dead white men. Like, that's the discipline that I work in. I regularly think through the classics of the Western intellectual canon. You know, so I'm very familiar with and committed to core Western values and ideas. But at the same time, at least for my part, a lot of this narrative of decline is something I'm suspicious about. So this episode, at least, is an opportunity to work some of those thoughts out. We thought that we would start off our discussion about these questions about the decline of Western civilization by looking at a controversy arose about a year ago when President Trump delivered a speech in Poland. And in that speech, Trump said this:
Americans, Poles, and nations of Europe value individual freedom and sovereignty. We must work together to confront forces, whether they come from inside or out, from the South or the East, that threaten over time to undermine these values and to erase the bonds of culture, faith, and tradition that make us who we are. If left unchecked, these forces will undermine our courage, sap our spirit, and weaken our will to defend ourselves and our societies.
And he later added in that speech, the defense of the West ultimately rests not only on means, but also on the will of its people to prevail and be successful and get what you have to have. The fundamental question of our time is whether the West has the will to survive. Do we have the confidence in our values to defend them at any cost? Do we have enough respect for our citizens to protect our borders? Do we have the desire and the courage to preserve our civilization in the face of those who would subvert and destroy it?
I'm sort of curious, Ed, what's your answer to his questions there? I mean, they're all yes or no questions. So how would you?
I think the questions are misguided questions.
So you're like the student who, on a test, writes, this is a bad question and I shouldn't have to answer it.
Well, I mean, I as we progress through this episode, you'll hear why I think it's a bad question. But yeah, I mean, not all questions are good questions, even though professors regularly tell the lie in class that there's no such thing as a bad question, which is a lie.
I never tell my students that. Although I do like the I think it's from the King Falls podcast. The line there are no stupid questions, only stupid people.
Sure.
I haven't used that in class yet because, you know, I'm not tenured yet, but someday.
What do you think the answer to the question is?
So do we have the confidence in our values to defend them at any cost? Probably not. Although who that we is and what those values are, of course, that's sort of the broader question.
That's the rub.
But to answer the question, I think probably not. Enough respect for our citizens to protect our borders, certainly not. And desire and courage to preserve our civilization in the face of those who would subvert and destroy it. Again, probably not. But I'm also a believer in various kinds of decline. So It makes sense that my answer would be no and your answer would be yes, given the different approaches to this.
Well, I mean, my answer is yes, to the extent to which I think that, I mean, these are the things that Trump wants to do, and I kind of expect that he's going to be at least partially successful. But in any case, again, I'm a little bit worried about the question. In any case, Trump's speech engendered a range of responses. Immediately after he gave the speech, some prominent progressive commentators saw it as being a pretty thinly veiled expression of white nationalist sentiment. So Jamel Bowie at Slate called it a white nationalist dog whistle. Peter Beinart at The Atlantic wrote, quote, "Trump's speech only makes sense as a statement of racial and religious paranoia. The South and East only threaten the West's survival if you see non-white, non-Christian immigrants as invaders. They only threaten the West's survival if by West you mean white Christian hegemony."
Which I suppose I didn't see this in any of the various responses to that, but I sort of feel the need to point out that he's giving this speech in Poland, and the East in Poland is Russia, right? I mean, it's not a question of, you know, non-white, non-Christian immigrants being invaders. At least that would be my read on it.
Yeah, but well,
I think Beinart's just got some bad geography going on here.
Well, it's south and east.
It is south and east, but again, it's not just that, right? It's you can't say it's, oh, clearly he's just going after the Muslim immigrants, because that's, again, assuming that it matters that this speech is given in Poland, that's clearly not the case.
Yeah, you know, I mean, so in some ways, I don't want to spend too much time parsing just how racist Trump's speech was. I bring it up as an example of a kind of a narrative of decline, or an example of a narrative that our civilization is under threat. And it's worth pointing out that there were immediately a whole range of conservative commentators who offered up equally vociferous defenses. I guess I'll just say this. I mean, context is important here. I mean, that's kind of one point that you're making, where the speech is given. I get that, but one thing about that here is that he's talking about the defense of the West as opposed to just the defense of Poland. And he says that the threats are what? Both inside and outside, and from the East and the South. And they're not just, it can't just be a worry about Russia to the East.
Well, I didn't say it was just a worry about Russia, but I said it is also that.
Sure. Well, that's fine. Right. But it can't just be that, because the threat is a threat to our values and the bonds of culture, faith, and tradition.
Right. So people who hold different values and different traditions and would use those values and traditions to undermine ours.
Sure.
As per their explicit statements to that end on occasion.
And so who are these people? Are these people Muslim immigrants?
So I would point to, what is his name? Putin's pet philosopher. I can throw the link up in the notes, but he basically comes out and says, yeah, this Western stuff has to go. It needs to be Russia all the way down.
Oh, Putin.
Again, you keep wanting to ignore that. And I don't think that is fair in the context of the speech. So yes, we could talk about radical Islam and what it's trying to do, but I think he's just making a broader point, as much as Trump puts any thought in anything. I mean, obviously, he didn't write this speech, and I doubt he could tell you anything that he said in it. But in terms of the content of the speech as it exists, yes, people who are not terribly friendly towards liberal democratic values, Western values, whatever you want to say, including radical Islam, including I don't even know what the names for it are. Revivalist Russianism or something. I don't know what you call that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm happy to include that the looming threat of Russia is a part of the speech. It's also worth pointing out, for what it's worth, that this speech was given a year ago. Things right. Are a little bit different a year ago, but in any case, that's certainly a part of it. I mean, that's what the reference to the East is. I guess I would also just say that's certainly not the only kind of worry that's looming there. Because again, he doesn't just talk about the East; he's talking about the South, and he's not just talking about Poland, but he says Americans, Poles, and the nations of Europe.
Right, and I think we can probably say that is stand-in for the West in general. Right, I don't think he's intending to exclude Australia or Japan or South Korea or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know about those. I don't know about those latter two places. But in any case, I mean, and then the other bit of context, I mean, you made that point about who wrote the speech. I expect we both know who wrote the speech because he still worked for the administration back then. Steve Bannon wrote the speech. And I mean, it would be one thing if you were in Poland and you gave this speech, and then I'd be like, oh, yeah, there's that standard kind of conservative narrative of decline. But you didn't give this speech. Donald Trump gave this speech written by Steve Bannon in Europe.
Yeah, and I have less respect for that sort of, because the person is bad, therefore everything he does must be bad kind of approach that many of the leftist responses to this took. Right. I mean, if Barack Obama had given this speech, which it's there are some phrases he wouldn't have used, but I mean, it's the sort of speech that he might have given. I don't think that would, you know, baptize it and make it good. I mean, the speech is good or the speech is bad. That we may not like the guy who gave it doesn't make it a good or a bad speech. It's what the content of the speech is.
Yeah, but it's very difficult to assess. I mean, you can't assess the content of the speech without appreciating the context, both where it's given and who's giving it, right?
I mean, it's a part of it, but it's given the sort of speech that it is. I think it's perfectly acceptable for a president to say, "Hey, America and our ally Poland, we're going to defend Western civilization."
I mean, I'll get to some worries that I have about that kind of talk in a bit. I don't think that kind of talk is necessarily racist. So I'll say that. But again, the speech was given about, I don't know, a month before the white supremacist demonstration in Charlottesville, Virginia, that Donald Trump refused to denounce. So, like, I just think that's an ineliminable part of the context of the speech that should shape the way that we interpret it. Even if you gave the speech, or if Ross Douthat gave the speech, or if Rod Dreher gave the speech, you know, I would just be like, okay, I know what that's about. I find that a little worrisome, but I don't necessarily think it's racist. But in any case, you didn't give the speech. Donald Trump gave the speech. But in any case, I actually didn't want to get too hung up on parsing just how racist the speech was. So anyways. But setting Trump's Poland speech aside, it certainly does raise themes that have become pretty standard parts of a conservative narrative of decline and the urgent need to rescue or preserve Western civilization from a variety of forces that are undermining it. And so I think it's makes a lot more sense for us to sort of focus on that narrative or criticism. And so, you know, here's an example from Ross Douthat. Actually, in the wake, writing about Trump's speech, but a little bit detached from it, Ross Douthat wrote this. On the evidence of recent European controversies, it is hard enough for a political union to reconcile the different branches of the West, German and Mediterranean, French and Anglo-Saxon. It becomes harder when that same union is trying to manage a society so multicultural as European nations under the pressure of mass migration may become, as to lack religious or linguistic or historical common ground. Today's Western nationalists argue, plausibly, that many European distinctives are unlikely to survive if nation-states are weak, mass immigration constant, Christianity and Judaism replaced by indifferentism and Islam, and young elites educated as global citizens without knowing their own home. This nationalist argument comes in racist forms, but it need not be the white nationalism that Trump's liberal critics read into his speech. It can just be a species of conservatism, which prefers to conduct cultural exchange carefully and forge new societies slowly, lest stability suffer, memory fail, and important things be lost. As such, it's a view I endorse. So there you get a nice, succinct little statement from Ross Douthat expressing a similar kind of worry about Western decline. And that's, you know, and that's the kind of thing that I wanted to focus on. Maybe the first thing to talk about is just what this thing called Western civilization is. You know, what is this West that bonds the European countries together? What is its significant history and content? Coyle, do you have sort of thoughts about the primary ingredients of that Western civilization?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's a tough one, right? So it is not non-Western civilization, and it is not barbarism. Now, whether it can be defined more than that, I think is problematic, and obviously we have the difficulty of having to include in our definition of Western civilization, you know, 2,500 years worth of history. And places as diverse as, the places and times as diverse as ancient Greece, ancient Rome, the Middle Ages, modern America, modern Australia. So I think one way you can look at it is sort of the historical view. Western civilization is everything. You know, Western civilization today, anyway, is the set of cultural institutions, set of I don't even know what a big enough word is other than just using civilization again. The entity that is shaped by Rome, Christianity, and the Germanic tribes that invaded Western Europe in the Middle Ages. So that's sort of the historical setting, right? And then all of the things that grow out of that. So Australia, America, Canada, and then nations that sort of jump onto that cultural view. So again, Japan, South Korea, so on. That's one way to look at it.
You would call Japan and South Korea Western parts of Western civilization.
I would call them parts of Western civilization. And we can talk about that because we could ask questions about China and modern day Russia as well.
Russia is a hard.
Well, Russia. I'm happy to say no with Russia. I think that's a harder question with the Soviet Union. Right. When Russia was the Soviet Union, it was in some ways intentionally defining itself against Western civilization. But obviously, communism is a development of Western civilization. And same thing with modern China. Right. It is a communist nation. But by adapting communism, they've taken something from the West and said, we're going to do this. And then in
adopting capitalism, it took something else.
And in the last, 40 years, becoming more and more capitalist, also taking something Western, which that may actually be part of what defines Western civilization. So different theories that have been given. Plato had argued that Western civilization, not that he uses that phrase specifically, right? He's speaking Greeks versus other peoples. Is the triumph of reason over the passions, right? The civilized folks are the folks who are governed by reason rather than governed by at best passions, at worst their appetites. Aristotle has some more nuanced.
Now that's something that Confucius and many other Eastern philosophical figures would have said.
Yep. Although Plato would not necessarily have been aware of that.
No, I mean, he almost certain. I mean, yeah, right. He wasn't.
Well, yeah. So I agree. That's an insufficient definition, but he uses it. Aristotle has more of a nuanced view. He talks about a civilization that is sort of balanced between nature and convention, right? So it is something that is both. Both an outgrowth of nature, both something that you find in the wild, and it's an artificial creation, right? It's something that that work goes into creating and developing, and central to both of that is the family. The family and private property, sort of standing side by side, form the basis of Western civilization, or again, he would just say civilization. So I don't know as much about medieval views of civilization, but jumping into sort of the German guys, Hegel argued that Western civilization is about the expansion of freedom. So if you have sort of the original civilizations in the ancient Near East, where you only have one person who is a free citizen, the king of Persia, the king of Babylon, and so on. And then Western civilization arises, and now you have more people who are free, the citizen body of Athens, the citizen body of Rome. And then we hit the culmination of Western civilization with the he says the arrival of Christianity. It's pretty clear he means both the arrival of Germany and the arrival of himself, with the where everyone is now free. Nietzsche argues that Western civilization, or again civilization in general, is all about the will to power, the willingness to go out and sort of force yourself on the world. Kind of taking Aristotle and twisting it in a different direction. So it is an art, but it's also a forceful art. A philosopher that some of the readings that we read for today talked about, a guy named Oswald Spengler, argues that Western civilization is inherently just expansion. As far as what is expanding, he's just not concerned with that, and he. I don't know if he comes right out and explicitly says neither are the citizens of Western civilization, but it is something that is in some ways it's like a cancer. The only thing it's really concerned with is its own growth, although he speaks much more positively about it than that. I actually think there is something to that. If you look at the way other nations are rushing to embrace some of what we have in the West, I think there is something to that argument, although, again, I'm not completely sold on it. And then in recent years, Victor Davis Hanson has argued that Western civilization, sort of the core component, he calls it courage. The idea that the individual, right, the single person is willing to stand up and face everyone else down and claim liberty and rights for himself. Right. So individualism, Hanson argues, is the thing that runs through this, but not just individualism, the individual sort of courageously saying, this is mine and you're not going to take it from me. And I'm better than you anyway. So you have no right to take it from me. And you might come and kill me, but I'm going to kill seven of you in the process, which I think is really another way of saying then, although again, Hanson doesn't say it this way, in that view, the defining characteristic of Western civilization is pride. I don't know which, if any of those are right. But those are a handful of definitions from, the past 2,500 years. Ed, what do you got? What is Western civilization to you?
So I'm happy to say that there is such a thing as Western civilization that is distinct from, I mean, you're right. Sometimes it's hard to find another word or synonym for civilization. It is what it is. That's distinct, so I'm happy to say that there is something about Western civilization that is distinctive from other kinds of civilizational, that's distinct from other kinds of civilizations. And I also understand why it's called Western, but I think that's a very misleading right. kind of description
it refers
in some
to
ways.
A distant past.
And I think
right,
that because
Rome was in the West and Persia or whatever was in the East, therefore Western civ.
Well, so I mean, typically we think of the West as beginning where? Somewhere east of Italy and west of Israel, right? So I mean just the Mediterranean nations, and I guess the Eastern Mediterranean nations.
Well, Greece, right? Western civilization begins in Greece, by most definitions.
So I would say this. Do you think that Greece is very simply a Western country?
I mean, I'm not necessarily saying modern Greece, ancient, classical era Greece, which of course spread. I mean, there were Greek cities all over the Mediterranean, but the ones that we care about mm-hmm. being primarily Athens and Sparta.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess I would just say this. So, I mean, geographically, Greece is sort of right at the dividing line of what we think of as being the West and the East.
Right.
And then culturally, I would say that Greek society, it's very complex and it's not just simply Western. The broader point that I wanted to get to is that what we call the West is in fact a pretty complex amalgam of sources, ideas, and traditions that originate from places that we actually don't think of as typically Western.
Sure.
I mean, I would actually say that the origins of it all aren't Western at all. So, for example, our number system and much of our mathematics originates from the Near East, right? It's the Arabic.
Well, yeah, but of course, by definition, the origin of something is not the thing itself.
Isn't the origin of something an extraordinarily important component of what it is and what shapes it?
I mean, it is and it isn't. Like, I am willing to say that my sort of modern life as a citizen of a Western nation is directly influenced by ancient Greece in a way that it is not directly influenced by ancient Phoenicia, even though the Greeks got their alphabet from the Phoenicians. That's not to say the Phoenicians are utterly irrelevant. It is to say that I am not a direct descendant of the Phoenician civilization in the same
way. Oh, for sure. But so here's my point. There are important constitutive components of what we call Western civilization that don't have their roots in the West. I mean, that's just the point, right? And so our number system, much mathematic and geometry originates from the Near East. I mean, one of the most important components to it all is our Judeo-Christian moral religious heritage that didn't arise in the West, right? That is an ancient Near Eastern religion.
Right.
And that tradition, as it grew in the Hellenistic world and in the Roman Empire, was also very importantly shaped in North Africa and the Middle East, right? We owe a super lot to Greek philosophy, which again lies at the crossroads of Europe and the Middle East. And so it's true, of course, that this tradition gets synthesized through the Greco-Roman world and the Roman Empire and taken up into and extended into Western Europe, like the West proper, and then through colonization through much of the rest of the world. I do think that Russia is a hard case. I mean, Russia has always understood itself as sort of being different to and other from the West, and sometimes wanting to be Western and sometimes fiercely resisting that. But it's certainly the case that some of the great artifacts of Western cultural heritage, whether you're talking about Tchaikovsky or Rachmaninoff or Tolstoy or Dostoevsky, right? They're all Russian. So Russia, I think, is a hard case. Set that aside. But the broader point is that, you know, I'm happy to call to say that there's such a thing as Western civilization. I think there's a reason why we call it Western. But it's also important to remember that actually the most important sources of that culture aren't necessarily Western or what we think of as being a part of the West.
I would say that is historically true, but it's maybe not that important. Like, it's fine, acknowledge it. It doesn't affect us the same way, right? I will say that even if I don't know sort of what Western civilization is, there are some characteristics of it that I think are important, and I don't know enough about non-Western civilizations to know if they're definitive or not. But unless we want to talk more about sort of the core definition, which I don't have anything else to add on that.
Well, yeah, no, I'm gonna add something on that. Okay. But I'm not sure if I understand like this kind of resistance to sort of saying, hey, look, a lot of this stuff, it didn't necessarily start in the West.
No, I'm fine with saying that. Yes, that's true.
I think that's especially with like the Judeo-Christian heritage, which imported very, very distinct moral ideas. I mean, especially about the intrinsic dignity and value of human beings, among others. But like, that is an idea that you uniquely find in Jewish religion and then developed through that weird sect of Judaism that we call Christianity. You know, and you didn't find that anywhere else in the ancient Near Eastern world. You certainly didn't see, you know, you didn't find that in Greco-Roman religion or anywhere in the pagan European world. Like, that is, I mean, that's a distinctive idea that has its roots in this weird ancient Near Eastern religion.
Right, and we'll certainly get to this at the end. Christianity is its own thing, right? It stands over and above and against all sort of civilizational divides, you know, Western and non-Western, civilization versus barbarism. I mean, it is something truly unique that should at least cut across all of these different systems out there.
Sure. And then, you know, so that I think is like the historical heritage of what we call Western civilization. And then with regard to like the content of Western civilization, I mean, I guess I would say that there are actually like three main ideas or values that kind of correspond to, I mean, philosophers will often say that they're like, there are three main areas of philosophical inquiry. There's epistemology, which is the study of knowledge and what knowledge is and how we get it. There's metaphysics, which is like the study of reality and what is real. And then there's ethics, which is obviously the study of what is right and wrong. And then I would say that, like, I mean, to me, the constitutive aspects of Western civilization are really rooted in a particular kind of epistemology, metaphysics, and ethics. Since I mentioned it, I'll start with the ethics. I mean, I think the ethics bit is that just that bit that I was talking about earlier. It's this inheritance that we get from this Judeo-Christian religious heritage. That's this really unique view about the nature of humanity, and that generates a corresponding kind of ethic related to that, right? And so very early on in the Bible, we are told that human beings are made in God's image, that God created humanity. In some mysterious sense, they're like God, and so have an intrinsic kind of value and dignity that deserves respect. And that is a unique idea in world philosophical and religious history. You know, from that idea, you get the idea that we have deep obligations to others, even if they aren't related to us. The idea of charity is a distinctively Christian virtue that didn't exist in the pagan ancient world. There's nothing like the virtue of charity for Aristotle or Plato. So that is a really important constitutive element, this particular kind of ethic. And then equally, I would say there is a particular kind of epistemology that you kind of mentioned earlier that really prizes our capacity to reason about the world objectively. That's a really important idea that leads to the development of a particular kind of science and technology. And then lastly, there is a corresponding metaphysic associated with all of that. And that's just the idea that God created the world and it's intelligible to us and that we can make sense of it. It's separate and distinct from us. It's orderly and uniform, so we can study it and learn to manipulate it. Those are three kinds of elements that are really central at getting to the heart of what Western civilization is about, I think. And from those three things, you start getting other kinds of elements that are also pretty central and constitutive of what it is. So like science and technology are really important constitutive parts of what Western civilization is about. Equally, I would say the kind of political institutions that evolve out of that, especially culminating in the development of liberal democratic polities, that's a really central part that really spills out of that corresponding epistemology, metaphysics, and ethics. So, I'm happy to say that there's such a thing as Western civilization. Though, as I noted earlier, there's a way in which I think that moniker is very misleading. On a tangential but slightly related note, who posted it? Nathan Gilmore posted this really fascinating article. I think it was in The Guardian, and it was written by an Oxford classics professor, sort of talking about conceptions of race in ancient Greece. That was really, really just fascinating. Did you see that? Did you see that post?
I saw it. I haven't read it yet.
It's really interesting, and just highlights the way in which, like, the way that we moderns think about race is just like so sort of historically particular. Like, they're just wholly different ways of thinking about other ethnicities. That's tangential but slightly related. Anyways, thoughts on that kind of story about the constitutive aspects of Western civilization?
I think I agree with some of it, and some of it I'm a little hesitant on because it. I think some of it describes sort of modern Western civilization, but it doesn't necessarily do a good job of embracing the whole, right? So It has to apply if we are thinking about Western civilization as a whole, not just meaning, you know, contemporary America, but also including, again, you know, the Greece and Rome and the Renaissance republics and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, obsession with science isn't a definition that works for all of those things. The Greeks and the Romans didn't care about science at all. They cared about sort of.
Oh, I mean, Aristotle was obsessed
Aristotle
with science.
Aristotle is kind of a weird obsession, a weird exception. And even then, he wasn't concerned with science in the way we mean it, right? He was concerned with science in terms of categorizing and classification, right? Not in terms of experimentation and coming up with new inventions and so on. They're concerned with things like pure math, right? Let's sit down and let's do, let's see how far we can carry geometry, and let's see how far we can carry these proofs, because these absolute truths will connect us to the eternal world, not because we can build a bunch of cool toys out of them.
But then they did use that math to build
a bunch of cool toys. Again, I mean, there's sort of the one guy, right? Archimedes is kind of the one person in the ancient world who does anything like that, and he gets killed.
All of the Greek philosophers, I mean, all of them have kind of quasi-scientific theories about the nature of the world. Aristotle was unique. I mean, I'm not an ancient philosopher. I mean, let me put the point this way. Aristotle was notable in having a particular kind of an eye for empirical research. But I don't understand why you don't count that as being proto-scientific. The construction of the pyramids, the interest in math.
Those things weren't Western civilization, Ed.
Of they're constitutive of Western civilization. That was the whole point, Coyle. And so, I mean, obviously science and technology are an extraordinarily important part of modern life. And they take on the particular shape and color that they have in the Enlightenment. But so it's true, of course, that the way in which we think about those things now is distinct, but they have their roots in an attitude towards reason and the world that are rooted in the ancient world.
Right. And since we picked the topic, since you came up with the topic a couple of days ago, I was thinking about what are characteristics of Western civilization, again, from then until now. And I also came up with a list of three. We didn't coordinate this. We just each came up with three things. The three things I've got, and I don't know enough about non-Western civilizations, I suppose, to know if these are typical of them or not. But I think they're not, based on, I guess, half-formed opinions. So I think one sort of definitive characteristic of Western civilization is a separation of the individual from the institution, right? So governments, military, chains of command, whatever. The office is not contingent on the individual who holds that office, or at least in theory isn't. So we can have a president, and it does matter which individual fills the office, but if something happens to that individual, it's not the end of the office, right? There's this separation of institutions from personal involvement of the individual.
It's weird to me that you include that one after that previous thing about wanting to embrace the continuity of Western civilization from its origins, because that's certainly a very modern idea.
It is not exactly a modern idea. The Romans, well, listeners can go and listen to our episodes on Rome. The idea is that there is this office of consul, right? We want competent people in the office. We want virtuous people in the office. But if something happens to one of them, we just replace them, right? It's not hereditary. It's not. I mean, even we have father son relationships. The idea is you still have to sort of get there on your own merits. The office goes on.
Yeah, but what about the office of Caesar?
And that was a serious objection that the Republican thinkers had to it before they were all executed. And even then, right, you have Caesars who don't like to use the language of this is a personal office. Now you have Caesars who do, but by and large, they tend to avoid that because, again, there's this understanding that there's this understanding that this institution is somehow supposed to stand on its own, in a way that when the Germanic tribes invade Europe, one of the reasons we can say that there's a collapse of civilization is because all of a sudden politics is all personal again. Right. Politics is all not all. Sorry. Apologies to the medievalists out there. I know it's more nuanced than that. But institutions are directly tied to people. And anyway, that's sort of one characteristic that I came up with. Second characteristic is the idea of the rule of law. So the idea that trying to think how to say this, and again, this may be something that extends across civilizations. I'm just ignorant enough of non-Western civilizations to not know that. But the idea that citizens ought to obey established norms and laws, regardless of whether or not the authority is personally present. Right. So again, there's that. I suppose that's just another way of saying the separation of institutions from the person. But I have certain civilized obligations that fall on me, even if I'm out working on my farm by myself. And there's some understanding that even if there's not a government official standing there enforcing them, I'm still obligated to follow through with these. You know, I suppose the way they would have said it in the olden days is the civilized individual is civilized regardless of where he is.
And laws apply equally to everybody.
Right, right.
In similar cases.
With you know, all proper nuance and respect to different forms of government and so on. And then the third thing is an emphasis on the individual. So yes, Christianity shapes the view of the individual, but even Greece and Rome had a sort of individualism about them, right? It was an individualism that they restricted to themselves. So if you were living in, you know, Athens in the 500s BC, they didn't really care about individual Persians. But if you were an Athenian citizen, that meant something, right? That actually had value, had certain legal rights, certain legal protections and so on. Same thing in Rome, same thing in every Western society that I am aware of. Again, maybe that's something non-Western societies do. I have absolutely no idea. But that seems to be something that's there sort of all the way, even if that definition of an individual changes over time, right? The Enlightenment view of the individual is very different than the Renaissance view of the individual, but they are both views of the individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that kind of individualism is a pretty important part of it. And certainly, I mean, yeah, and you see that. You see that going on.
Right. So when
Achilles
stands up to Agamemnon and says, I'm not going to listen to you because I'm a better warrior than you are. And Agamemnon basically has to say, yeah, you're right. You know, that's not the sort of thing anyone is ever going to say to, you know, Ramses II or Nebuchadnezzar or, I don't know, name your king figure in whatever non-Western culture I suppose you care to talk about.
Yeah. So you get these... You know, you get these constitutive ideals or values, and then these ideals and values shape particular kinds of institutions, social institutions, political institutions, the activity of scientific investigation and technology. The ideals get instantiated and perpetuated through cultural artifacts, like music and food and literature and art and all of that, that sort of carry on this ideal of Western civilization that we're all now familiar with. So if that's what Western civilization is it in decline? Or what are the ways in which it's in decline?
Yeah, so I think there's at least one way it's in decline that I think is pretty much inarguable, and none of the readings we talked about dealt with this. I don't have these statistics for other nations, but I assume they are either similar or worse. And I guess I'm springing this on you, so maybe that's not fair. You are free to not respond to this if you like. In the United States. We've got a population of what, like 320 million, something like that now. There are, as of 2015, 4 million farmers left in the country. And the average age amongst American farmers is 58. So is Western civilization in decline? Absolutely. We are going to run out of food. Not because we don't have land and not because we don't have the ability to grow it, but because we don't have the people who are willing to do it. That's generally not what people mean when they talk about decline of civilizations. But I mean, if you want to kill a civilization, the fastest and best way to do it is to cut off its food supply.
So look, I mean, I think that agriculture is really important, but we're not going to run out of food in the United States.
You know, you say that, Ed, but your food comes from somewhere.
I mean, yeah, that's right. It comes from big corporate farms. So like, but
no, that's counting big corporate farms, right? That's counting their employees in that 4 million farmers.
Okay, so
that's counting illegal immigrants. That is counting all agricultural workers, I guess, as of the 2010 census, you know, the last census.
So maybe that's fine. Let's say that's right. I mean, it's obviously the case that because of technological advances, we're able to farm much more land with fewer hands. I mean, you know, what matters isn't, I mean, like, that can't be right. I mean, that's like saying because there are fewer auto workers, we're making fewer cars. Yeah, there are fewer farmers. Maybe that's lamentable for a variety of other reasons, but it can't be because we're producing less food. I mean, we're producing more food than we ever had. And we're doing it because we have technologies that enable us to do the labor with faster and with fewer hands. You know, in the old days, you would be out there. I mean, I don't know. You would need scores of people to go through and pick, or you would need, you know, you would be plowing your field with your, you know, your mule and your plow. And
that's why I specifically didn't mention food output or numbers of acres under tillage. I mentioned the age of the people doing it. That number is increasing. It's so since in 2000, the average age of a farmer was 50. Mm-hmm. In 2010, it was 58. Mm-hmm. So yes, but there is a tipping point where it doesn't matter what the technology is. If there aren't people to actually do it, then the food isn't going to
come. I mean, for one thing, like one dude in an air-conditioned, GPS-guided tractor can plow and sow and harvest. I mean, how many acres in a day? Like,
it depends on all sorts of factors.
Hundreds, so right?
No. We don't need to get into that.
But you see my point. I mean, and then frankly, we're not even going to need the dude. We don't even need the dude in the tractor anymore. Like, eventually it's just going to be replaced by robots. And the robot tractor will plow, seed, and harvest the field. I mean, it gets complicated. Like, you won't need a human being to plant and harvest corn, right? That's done mechanically right now, right?
I mean, there are still people in the tractors.
But yeah, oh yeah, right. But I mean, that doesn't need to be handpicked. Like, eventually you won't even need the dude in the tractor. I mean, you'll probably need some people in sorting. But even then, I mean, they're just automating everything. Some things are harder. Like, it's going to be hard, but not impossible, to get a machine to pick strawberries. But like, you know, there are labs right now who are working on strawberry picking robots.
So you're showing that you're a very sort of modern Western individual. You know,
I'm not even saying that that's a good thing, but that is what's going to happen. We're not going to run out of food.
Which is,
I mean, we might run out of the ability to grow food because of global warming and drought, but we're not going to run out of food because there are not enough farmers.
Right. Which again is that very sort of Western. The technology will do what we need.
That's absolutely right. That is the classic Western view of science and technology.
It's like you're reading out of a 1950s sci-fi novel.
Yeah, except it's not. It ain't the 1950s, and it's not science fiction. It's science reality. And I'm not like celebrating this as being this amazing, awesome thing. I mean, I'm kind of skeptical about a lot of that stuff.
Right.
But that is like, that's literally what's happening. I mean, it's happening everywhere. Well,
and again, that's not usually what people mean when they talk about decline of Western civilization.
No.
Usually what they mean is decline of sort of moral coherence, the loosing of traditional restraints. And this again wasn't on the reading list, but I think it's a good one. So Robert Bork, in his book Slouching Towards Gomorrah, talks about decline. I think the name of the chapter, although I haven't read this since high school, clearly it stuck with me a little bit. The chapter is called The Vertical Invasion of Barbarians, where he talks about sort of the difference between civilization and barbarism, although I think it works better in a decline context, is the difference between people who want to sort of shore up and buttress and properly use existing institutions and people who intentionally want to tear them down. Right. So one way that especially conservatives tend to talk about decline is the erosion of our traditional institutions, tearing apart of established norms and practices, especially ethical ones. But we can apply that sort of to all of them. So if we're looking at American government, we might talk about the rise of the imperial presidency at the expense of a traditionally active Congress.
Sure. And is that, I mean, not everybody would say that that's a bad thing.
Right. Barbarians would be like, yeah, this is awesome.
No. Yeah, so I mean, you mentioned the loosening of moral restrictions. Is there anything else that you wanted to add?
I mean, we could pick like individual ones that people are concerned about, but yeah, I think that would end up being.
No, I think it's most helpful to try to get like a list of categories of kinds.
Oh,
of
and
things
I, yeah, and then, I would just worry about rabbit and, trails with that. So we could, I guess, as an example, right? So earlier. Mentioned that Aristotle talks about the family as being central in sort of the state or one of the central aspects of the state. Well, the changing definition of family, right? Taking what a family is and sort of reconstructing it according to the popular trend of the moment, as opposed to protecting it in continuity as it has existed in Western civilization since, you know, back in the day, although of course it has changed over time, you have to take that into account also.
Back
in which day? Yeah, that would be an example. Although again, I wouldn't want to go down that rabbit trail too far. Since you're sort of on the political other side from me, what sorts of things pop into your head when you think conservative narrative of decline, of moral decline?
Yeah. So. So let me just say this. Let's make a distinction between like examples of the decline and the sources of the decline. And I guess when we're thinking about examples of decline, a lot of it just focuses on the kind of loosening of traditional moral restrictions or the coarsening of society. So what are we talking about? I mean, sexual morality is a really big part of this. Yeah. And, you know, with that general narrative of decline, I'm super skeptical about that. And I almost think that I'm not sure if I think that the question is incoherent or if it's just clearly the case that it's not a narrative of decline. But so I'll say this, like we certainly face problems these days, and some of the problems that we face are unique, even historically unique and dire. Like that's certainly the case. But I don't know that there's any clear sense in which things are worse these days than they used to be. And again, like, I don't know if the question makes sense, or I'm inclined to think that things are substantially better. And like, you know, these examples of decline, I think, can be very historically selective or short-sighted. So, I mean, a great source of concern amongst social conservative these days is like the concerns sexual morality, whether we're talking about same-sex attraction or the structure of the family, or sexual promiscuity outside of traditional monogamous heterosexual marriage. And like, that's obviously a break from recent historical norms, but you know, it's obviously not like there wasn't promiscuity in the early 20th century or in the, you know, in the 19th century. And then even more than that, like, you know, we could go back and we could talk about ancient Greek sexual ethics, you know, in which amongst a certain class of wealthy, propertied Greek citizen, there was a kind of an expectation that you would have a young male lover. And that even like sex with women in some ways was really kind of frowned upon, that it was seen as being a kind of a low and a mean thing to do. I'm a person with a traditional sexual ethic, but I'm pretty sure that our situation now is better than the situation in ancient Athens.
Well, it depends on what you mean by situation, right? And I think to some extent, one of the problems with discussions of decline, especially on the conservative side, conservatives I think are most guilty of this, is that a lot of the time it's not so much that what they're talking about is actual decline. It's that they lost on a given issue politically, right? So they wanted something to happen and it didn't happen, or they didn't want something to happen and it did happen. And rather than just say, yes, we lost and move on, it becomes, no, this is a sign of the end of civilization. And that I think is always kind of unfortunate, because it's not necessarily that. So I think that's one problem with sort of discussions of decline. The other problem is often what is meant really is more of a spiritual decline rather than a kind of tangible physical reality. So yeah, if we're talking about the decline of the West, obviously today we don't mean that, you know, technologically, right? It's not the case that things are getting worse technologically. Although we could talk about the effects of technology on us, right? What is the spiritual effect on an individual of having a screen in front of your face every waking hour? Well, it may be a good thing that the screen exists. It may be a good thing that we have this access and connection in some ways. Does that mean that we are spiritually healthier today than individuals were, you know, 80 years ago? Well, I think that's where the discussion becomes very difficult, because in one sense things are better, and in a way that is sort of physical and tangible. And yes, I could hold that iPad in my hand if I had the kind of job that paid me enough to buy an iPad. I could hold it in my hand and I could be like, hey, this is reality. And that is not a shot at my employer. That's a shot at the price of iPads. Whereas the argument that, yeah, but you are worse off now than people were, that's very intangible, right? It's raising that thing that can't be measured and saying that this matters and this is important. As I guess as a parallel, although I don't think this is a perfect parallel, it's sort of the idea that when you are sharing the gospel with someone, you've got to convince them that they're a sinner before you can talk about salvation and repentance and so on, right? It's that role of the law in evangelism that has to come first. Well, in the same way, the conservatives who believe in decline have to make the case that, yeah, decline is actually happening, even when in some ways it looks like things are getting better.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of spiritual... that gets a little bit about whether or not the question even makes sense. I mean, so would you say that things are better now, things are worse now than they were 50 years ago or 100 years ago or 150 years ago or 500 years ago?
Yeah, and again, I think some of that is going to depend on what things you're talking about, right? So for African Americans, in some ways, things are better today than they've ever been.
Yeah.
Right? There's no more Jim Crow.
Yeah.
Slavery has been gone for a century and a half at this point. Things are better now than they have been in the past. And again, technologically, things are better now. Medically, things are better now. In terms of the daily conveniences, things are better now. Are people harder working today than they were a century ago? Absolutely not. I mean, absolutely not. I don't think any reasonable person can say that the average Westerner is harder working today than they were a century ago. So it depends on what we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that by itself hard workingness is
– as a single example, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I agree with that. That's the way in which I think the question is kind of incoherent. Certainly, we face problems that worry me. I mean, among those problems is a certain kind of social dislocation that happens. I'm going to get back to that spiritual decline thing in a second. But I don't know that it makes sense at all to say that, oh, things used to be so much better in the 50s. I mean, maybe in certain respects. But oftentimes, I think that appeals to a kind of a nostalgic vision of what the past was like, or a very historically short-sighted or selective vision of what the past was like. You know, people complain about music and art and all of that. I don't know if any of that makes any sense. And I mean, with regard to that spiritual decline, I mean, it's certainly the case that there are more Christians living in the world today than there have ever been, right?
Right.
So that's a good thing. I guess a little bit more what you meant when you talked about the spiritual decline was that kind of social dislocation and isolation and depression and all of that.
Do you know your neighbor better today than people would have known their neighbors? And by neighbor, I mean the person who physically lives next door to you, right? Do you know them better today than people would have known 50 years ago, 100 years ago, whatever?
Yeah. So that's sort of picking out like a specific kind of modern social trend that I do think is problematic.
Well, and even to think through the, we each had our list of things that are Western civilization-ish, right? I think aside from your one about science, which Americans are, obsessed with science, are those still where they were, right? That epistemology of seeing the world as an objective truth, right? Is that still solid, or has that gone into radical decline? Well, I think that answer is pretty obvious, right? Everyone has their own truth, and that's what matters. Never mind reality, right? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned that. I mean, I would just say that the threats or challenges that Western civilization is experiencing, those are internal threats. Those epistemological challenges, like that doesn't come from Islam or from Russia or alternative civilizations. That kind of skepticism about knowledge, I mean, in some ways that skepticism about knowledge has always been a part of the Western tradition. There are ancient skeptics, there are medieval skeptics, there are modern skeptics. Postmodern skepticism takes on a particular kind of a new form. I sometimes think that talk about postmodern skepticism is kind of overstated, and I find all of that talk passe. But sure, I mean, there's this thing that's called postmodern skepticism. But like that is an internal challenge. Like those are aspects of contemporary Western civilization arising from the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was a tremendous achievement in many ways, but it also had certain kinds of internal inconsistencies or challenges. And like those challenges are working themselves out. But that certainly isn't any kind of challenge that comes from outside of us, even less from the East and from the South, right?
Well, right. I guess I don't know how much we want to get into some of that. The challenges from the East and the South, as much as they are not real challenges, right? As people who don't live in Europe, I don't actually have much of a, view on how much of a challenge Russia really is. And I don't even really have a sense for how much of a challenge radical Islam really is, because there just aren't that many Muslims in the United States. There's no context and there's no perspective. So I know that, I have friends who were living in Britain when the Scottish referendum was going on. Well, this was what, 2013, 2014, something like that. And, Scotland was voting on independence. And one of their concerns was, well, look, if Scotland votes to separate from the United Kingdom, what are we going to do with all of these enclaves of Islam scattered throughout the United Kingdom, especially in the major cities, who are going to stand up and say, you know what? We want our own governments and they're going to be governed by Sharia law. Right? How do you say no when you're letting Scotland do this thing? So I don't think we have anything like that in the United States. Like we don't have that kind of discussion going on right now.
Those conversations about worries about Muslim communities being operated by Sharia law is such a weird kind of conspiratorial trope that arises that I just do not know how to make sense of it. Your general point gets to something that's a part of these narratives, you know, so we talked a little bit about like the effects, you know, like what are the causes? And one thing that Douthat and French and Rod Dreher, like the point that they all make, I mean, they're really concerned about migration and just the dilution of non-traditionally Western people moving into these places.
Well, I don't know that they're they're as much concerned about immigration, although I don't remember any of the articles we read for today talking extensively about that.
No, but, that is such a part, right? So like this is,
I mean, the concern isn't just immigration, right? It's immigration plus, are they assimilating?
Sure. But I mean, yeah, they're worries about assimilation, right? But they're worried about multiculturalism, right? So again, like Ross Douthat, European distinctives are unlikely to survive if nation states are weak, mass immigration constant, Christianity and Judaism replaced by indifference in Islam, and young elites educated as global citizens without knowing their own home. Rod Dreher talks about that as well. Like assimilating people, like that is a real issue. I mean, if you have people who do not respect liberal values, like that's a problem for a society.
Well, for a liberal society. For a liberal society, anyway, less of a problem.
Yeah. And I think liberal society, you know, capital L liberal, not little L, or is it little L liberal, not capital? You know what I mean? Like the sense in which you and I are both liberals. Like that's an important thing, but. Like those worries, there have always been those worries about immigrants. There are all, you know, whether the immigrants in question were Catholic or Italian, whether they were Chinese, there's always this worry, oh, these people aren't like us. They're going to cause problems. They're going to dilute our society. It's the decline of Western civilization. Right. And it's never like that. Like these are worries that are born out of kind of a fear of the other. And it's just never like that. There are often challenges for immigrants who come to the United States in that first generation, just because there's a lot of cultural assimilation that goes on. And you certainly get enclaves that are very, that preserve native ethnic cultures that like in which people aren't assimilating.
And for what it's worth, I am not one of those who gets up in arms. We haven't done an immigration episode yet, but you're right. Historically, those arguments are always there. And kind of my response is, look, just wait a generation. Now, a couple of generations, assimilation is not going on, then maybe you've got a problem, right? Then maybe there's some kind of issue. That first generation, just they're not going to assimilate, or at least not going to assimilate well, assuming that there are enough of the immigrants from wherever they're immigrating from to form their own subculture, they're not going to. It's the next generation that does.
Well, I mean, I'll say this. I mean, a lot of first generation, I mean, probably even most first generation immigrants assimilate pretty well. I mean, my parents, I mean, they came in with a lot of social and cultural capital. But, you know, they came from South Korea. Sure. They didn't speak English as a first language. But they were both professionals. I mean, this is the sense in which they came with a lot of social and cultural capital,
sure,
if not actual capital. But, you know, they are professionals. My mom's a physician. My father's a college professor. They assimilated very quickly. I expect – well, you know, and there's a whole spectrum. There are people who move into enclaves in cities or communities and can effectively continue to live as they did in the old world.
And right. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Well, within reason. I was actually talking to a friend of mine back when I lived in DC who was moving from I don't know if I'm supposed to say where. I don't want him to get in trouble, but a Middle Eastern country that is, formally Muslim. And we were sort of chatting about, what sorts of, things were going to change. And he was, sort of full speed ahead for, I'm going to be an American and I'm going to be a good American and like, awesome, great. So, someday you get married, you have a kid, your kid converts to Christianity. You're fine with that, right? All of a sudden, absolutely not. I will disown him. If we're in Saudi Arabia, severe legal penalties for that. So, but his kid will not have that idea, right? His kid will not have that attitude towards sort of the cultural and political ramifications because it takes a generation, right? Those things don't just change overnight.
Mm-hmm. And I would say, like, in some ways, one of the most powerful aspects of Western civilization is precisely, and like this gets back to those origin stories, but it's precisely that it's so good at assimilating people. I mean, there's certain core values that I think are inescapable. And if we're talking in a social political context, it's primarily, this idea of liberal rights, rule of law, and democratic rule. And like, if you have non-liberal peoples, like that's a problem. But the Western idea is a powerful idea. People eventually get assimilated. It might be the case that Islam in some ways presents unique challenges. There's a way in which Islam isn't a modern religion in the way that Christianity is. But for what it's worth, I mean, Christianity, it had to go through its own reformation. All of that talk that you see from Douthat and from Rod Dreher and all of these people just worried about immigrants, that to me just seems to be part and parcel of a very familiar kind of worry that people have had about immigrants in our country that have never proven to be true. And then immigrants come and they bring a vitality and energy. They bring ideas, and then the best of those ideas get assimilated and co-opted by our culture and become familiar aspects of what it is to be Western or what it is to be American. I mean, that is a kind of a story or narrative that some of these commentators often tell, and I just don't know what it's getting.
And again, I agree with you that those sorts of narratives, again, especially in an American context, really those guys just need to be more conservative. They just need to be patient and wait, and it'll be fine. Right? That's not going to be the source of American or Western decline. I can't speak for European nations. I don't know enough about those. I don't know enough about what's going on the ground there. But we that's not a problem here.
So, maybe we can sort of back out and look at the big picture.
Well, I guess we.
So is Western civilization in decline?
Well, yeah. So I guess the thing we haven't talked about is like you said, the internal challenge, right? This question that or the idea that the true challenge is not from people from the outside coming in, and it's not even really from Russia or communist China or wherever. It's from the people within Western civilization who say, hey, all of this Western civilization stuff, these values and these traditions, at best, they're just power plays and really they're just wicked. Right. That's, mm-hmm. I think, where the better discussion happens. Right. That's all of those college professors from the 60s who ruined everything. Right.
So, let's talk about that. I mean, I would say this. Certainly there are aspects of Western civilization that are problematic and in need of reform, right?
Sure.
I mean, a lot of the things that you just said, like, are true. Hegemony and violence and exclusion, some pretty nasty histories here and around the world, like all of those. All of those things are true. And then I would say they're particularly problematic precisely because they're in conflict with what our core Western values, I would say. So I'm sympathetic with a lot of those criticisms of, I'm extremely sympathetic with a lot of those criticisms of Western civilization. I guess I would say that, like, the better way to put the point is that the problem is that Western civilization is incoherent with itself, and that, you know, traditions have elements within them that are sometimes inconsistent and incoherent, and they get worked out over time. And so over time, as the tradition evolves, it is becoming more truly itself, you know, becoming a smoother stone as the inconsistencies and incoherences get buffed away. And so, I mean, I think those worries are better expressed as, no, like, I want a Western civilization that is more true to itself. These practices or these problems are problematic precisely because they are inconsistent with Western conceptions of human dignity and equality. That's why we need to care about them. Sure. And then there's value in highlighting the ideas or philosophies or cultural artifacts of other cultures, precisely because they can act as instruments of critique of Western culture to help us realize the ways in which we need to become more truly and fully ourselves. And that's it, and like that appreciation of difference and diversity is itself a part of Western civilization.
A fairly unique part of modern Western civilization anyway.
Yeah, totally. And so there's something like the most amazing thing about Western civilization is precisely because it's hospitable to other kinds of civilizations. Maybe that's the way in which only Western civilization can truly be a multicultural civilization, and one that actually has space for cultural difference.
I mean,
certainly other kinds of civilizations, I think, have less. I should be careful here because it's not like I'm a scholar of non-Western philosophy and religion, but I think are less accommodating in that way.
Right. I mean, I to push back on your narrative just a little bit, although we're running long, so maybe I shouldn't do too much of this. But it's certainly possible that over time the conflicts and contradictions and kinks in Western civilization all get worked out. I mean, it's also the case that occasionally they don't, and you have a collapse, and you've got to reset a little bit and then start over. Yeah, sometimes these things are resolved and they get better, and sometimes there's a dark ages.
It's true, and yeah, I think they're. So that's Rod Dreher talk a little bit. You know, I worry about that. And that's a way in which I think, I don't know, you know, I certainly don't think that things are worse now than they used to be 50 or 100 or 150 years ago. But that's not to say that I don't think that we don't face really severe, even existential problems. Nuclear war is as likely as it's ever been in a really, really long time. That is an extremely severe existential crisis. Equally, you know, I would say, I mean, around the world, we see these revivals of right-wing movements, you know, throughout the Western world that I think is arising out of economic dislocation and inequality that I think arise out of the way in which a kind of laissez-faire capitalism has reared its head again since the 70s. So Robert Kuttner has a book about all of this that's really interesting. It's called Can Democracy Survive Global Capitalism? And he tells a narrative about economic growth in the 20th century, the post-war expansion that kind of came to a grinding halt in the 70s when you got this revival of neoliberal laissez-faire economic thought that's created tremendous amounts of wealth. But the problem is that wealth isn't being shared. You're getting growing inequality and growing insecurity that Kuttner thinks is driving a lot of this social upheaval that we're experiencing. Like, I'm super worried about all of that stuff. I think that is a threat, maybe even a kind of an existential threat. But I don't know if and that's an instance in which I think the West capitalism is like an essential part of Western civilization. But it's an idea that created a tremendous amount of advancement and economic growth and reduction in human misery, but I think it's also an idea that is unstable, and that's one of those instances. I think a giant climactic instance of the Western tradition needing to work out its own incoherences, and there's no guarantee that we're going to get it right. That's a way in which I think we're wrestling with really, really deep challenges. I just don't know if those challenges are best understood as being a part of a kind of a narrative of decline. I probably just said about 20 different things that you're upset about.
Not 20.
But we're just running out of time, Close. You're going to have to sit on those thoughts.
That's fine. We should do some theological stuff, though, before we close out.
Yeah, good. So what do you have in mind?
I have sort of the two sides of my mind. One side is like, look, as a citizen of a Western nation, then yeah, I want to continue to do all of the good stuff that Western civilization does, and I want to change the bad stuff that Western civilization does. Slavery pops up every now and then and has to be stamped out and so on. But then as a Christian, so I mean that's sort of the enjoy the peace of Babylon type thing. That the Christians are told to do, but also to remember that it's the peace of Babylon, right? At the end of the day, Western civilization doesn't matter that much, any more than it matters if you're living in Eastern civilization or non-Western civilization, whatever you want to call it. If you're living in a state of barbarism, right? The gospel is what matters, and that transcends all of those lines. Right, that trumps basically everything else. Your state with God and your relationship to the church, that's what matters. Not institutions and not traditions and not societal ethical norms and all of those things. Which isn't to say they're not important, just that they are not primary. So, I guess the good news of Christianity, at least one implication, one aspect of the good news of Christianity is. You can be as down on Western civilization as you want. That's fine, because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter that much.
Mm. Yeah, and I would just agree with that and say, in some ways, one of the things that worries me the most about these narratives of decline is especially when Christians talk about this and try to suggest that like somehow we have a special kind of stake in it as Christians. And again, like, I love me some Western civilization, but that kind of talk has seen Christianity really co-opted by a kind of a nationalism. I mean, especially in the United States, but in elsewhere
right. And,
too, I suppose.
And some of that's historical, right? There were Christians in the past that I otherwise have a lot of respect for, but who had this very unbiblical idea that you can sort of take the Bible and forge a Christian-looking nation. And that sort of mm-hmm. inserts itself into our mindset, so that today, even though we're living in a society and a nation that is clearly secular, there's this desire to sort of go back to this imagined past, where the nation was quote unquote Christian, and as far as I know, that's basically only happened in the Western world. So there's that identity with Western civilization, which obviously is influenced by Christianity. I'm not saying it's not, but that's part of the look. Let's celebrate and appreciate what's good about it and condemn what's not. And if we don't live in a Western nation, do exactly the same thing, just in the different setting.
Yeah, yeah. All of that really co-opts our understanding of what the gospel is all about.
Right.
Well, I thank you for indulging this question. This has been a little bit of a surprising conversation again for me, but it's been helpful for me to sort of work out what I think.
You didn't see those farmers coming, did you, Ed?
The farmers threw me for a loop, man. I didn't know. I think that corn tastes better when it's been picked by a machine, and it hasn't been sullied by the dirty hands of some human being.
You don't think it tastes better when it's been like triple processed and turned into sugar?
Oh, definitely. In fact, and then when our meat is grown in petri dishes, I'm sure you'll look forward to eating that steak that like didn't even come from an animal but was literally grown in a petri dish somewhere. Do you know about that?
I do know about that.
Yeah. I look forward to going to a biological steakhouse with you one day.
No.
Until that day happens, let me remind everybody that the City of Man podcast are members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. You should check out our website at christianhumanist.org. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. To learn more about our show, to interact with us, to contact us, please visit our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. Check out our iTunes page. Go there and leave us a review of the 5-star variety, especially. Or if you prefer the good old-fashioned way, you can email us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. And in any case, let me remind everyone to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks a lot for listening.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway,